In today's episode...
Well, I remember there was a local newspaper, because we were in Cirencester, which is right in the middle of a sort of farming world. We always used to joke that, you know, we kind of misread the memo, and instead of setting up in Silicon Valley, we set up in Stroud Valley in the middle of Gloucestershire. But I remember the local newspaper, I think it was called the Wilts and Gloss Echo or something. Yeah. I remember they came to photograph us and they wanted some sort of glamour picture. And I don't actually have this picture. I'm sure someone's got it.
Sure, we can dig it out from the internet.
And I think there's me, Ben and Rory, and they insisted on us holding a sort of obligatory bottle of champagne and draped over. I think at the time, one of us already had quite a flash car. So we were sort of draped over the bonnet of a smart car holding a bottle of champagne. And it was all like very naff and like parochial. But I can remember that quite clearly, yeah.
This is Bilal Zaidi, and you're listening to Creator Lab, where I learn how to turn ideas into action. I'll bring you conversations with leading entrepreneurs, nonprofit founders, award-winning designers, educators, artists, and everything else in between. We dig deep into their stories, have honest conversations about how they made their ideas come to life, and the lessons learned along the way. This episode is sponsored by InstaSleep Mint Melts, the drug-free, convenient sleep aid that melts in your mouth. They were invented by the physician called Dr. Lee during his medical residency, where he saw the need for an effective sleep aid that didn't contain harmful chemicals, cause addiction, or leave him feeling groggy in the morning. I've used them myself for long flights and for sorting out my sleeping pattern after a trip. They taste like mints and are really convenient since they melt in your mouth. InstaSleep Mint Melts are now available at Target, Amazon, or directly on their site at instasleep.co. Hi, Joss. Thanks for being on the show.
Hi, Bilal. Yeah, good talking to you. And I'm looking forward to our chat.
Yeah. Why don't we just start off by, if you could just introduce yourself.
My name is Joss White. I see myself as an entrepreneur turned investor. I've had quite a wide and varied entrepreneurial journey, and then for the last few years I've been an investor.
That's great. And we're going to go into quite a lot of detail about the different companies you set up, but just there were three in particular that had quite large exits. Could you just give us a summary of what they were?
Sure. The first one was called RBR Networks, which was a Cisco supplier, a Cisco distribution business. They're set up in the early 90s, which we sold to Datatech for about $50 million in 1998. The second one was called Star, which was one of the UK's first ISPs, which we founded in, when I say we, it's myself and my brother, Ben. We founded in 1996 and sold to Clarinet for about $90 million. And then we founded a business called Message Labs in 2000, which was a software as a service, antivirus, anti-spam email security company, which we sold to Symantec in 2008 for around about $700 million.
Well, we're going to work up to how you set those up and the story behind that. But why don't we just go back right to the beginning from your childhood even. So just, I'd love to hear kind of what you were like as a kid. Were there certain subjects you like at school? Were you quiet? Were you outgoing? What were you like just in your early years?
I was born in London, in West London. My parents moved out of London when I was about 6 years old to Gloucestershire, and felt that we should be brought up in the English countryside. So it was around about 75, 76, moved to the country. Most of my memories are really of being brought up in the English countryside. I've only got very sort of vague memories of London before then.
Yeah.
I guess I enjoyed being out and about, out in the open air. I went to the local village school to start with, and then I actually went away to private school. I went away to boarding school from the age of 8 all the way through to the age of 18. So I went to two different boarding schools. And I think going to boarding school from quite a young age is an interesting experience. I think it generally makes you very independent and kind of accomplished in some ways. But I think in other ways, it can make you sort of emotionally a little bit repressed, because that's just the way that you deal with going away to boarding school at the age of eight. I'm thinking my son is nearly seven and I can't imagine him going away to boarding school right now. And I wouldn't want him to either. So it felt a bit Victorian, a bit early to be going away. And I think that maybe sort of, you know, influenced my the way that I developed as a person to some extent.
Yeah. And was your brother, who you eventually set up these businesses with, did he go to school with you too at the boarding school?
He did. Yeah, he went. My brother went to the same prep school as me. He then actually went on a bit of a whistle-stop tour of various different schools. He is heavily dyslexic, and I think the way he dealt with that was just to be a rebel and break as many rules as he could.
Yeah.
So he actually went to a school. He went to Cheltenham College and he was expelled from there. And then I went he went to Stowe and I went to Stowe. But Ben was actually expelled from Stowe as well.
What did he do to get expelled?
Cheltenham, you know, I can't remember what happened. But at Stowe, he had a car. He'd bought a car and exchange in Mart for like £50 or something.
All right.
And him and a friend kept the car on the school grounds, kept it hidden with some branches and stuff. And they used to just take it out in the middle of the night and drive to local towns and stuff. And eventually the car
they
was found.
They found out.
Yeah. And actually, there is quite a strong... we went to the same school as Richard Branson.
Oh, really? All right.
Stowe. And
were you there at the same time?
No.
Okay.
No, but he was also expelled from Stowe, and I was expelled like a year before the end. Ben was expelled from multiple schools. When you actually look into it, there's quite a strong correlation between academic failure and entrepreneurial success.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Because I think as an entrepreneur, you need to break some rules. You need to be prepared to take some risks. And also you haven't got much choice but to set up your own company. If you fail miserably at school, you've got to kind of do your own thing.
Yeah. So what did you get expelled for?
Well, they never really caught me doing anything really major. And I think that's what frustrated them more than anything.
Okay.
So there is an accumulation of kind of smoking and drinking and,
okay,
you know, being caught out after hours and that sort of thing. But there was no one major incident. I think that they just recommended to my parents that I leave a year early. Otherwise, you know, there's going to be a major incident and that's not going to be good for me.
Okay.
So they sort of very firmly persuaded my parents to take me out of the school. So I don't know whether it was a formal expulsion or not, but
yeah.
I ended up leaving a year early, and then I which I thought was great. So then me and a friend rented a flat in Oxford, and I went to a tutorial college in Oxford to do my A-levels. And so there I was living in a flat as an independent guy from the age of 17 in Oxford. So I had a brilliant time.
But so what were you like at school? Were you a good student?
You know, I was a reasonably good student, but only because I was very good at, I have a good short-term memory, or I used to, I'm not sure I do anymore. But I used to be very good at cramming. So for a couple of days before an exam, I could really, really cram and I could take in information and I could regurgitate that information. So I generally did pretty well at my O-levels and even my A-levels, even though by that time I was in Oxford and partying hard and living with a friend in a flat.
Yeah.
I did reasonably well, but I think that was a sort of failing of the exam system, because just having a good short-term memory enabled me to sort of blag it. Whereas I think now the exams are different. You actually have to demonstrate that you're participating, and it's more about coursework and you know, your ongoing involvement with a subject, which is probably a fairer way to do it.
Yeah.
But I managed to do reasonably well.
That's great. What did you study at A-levels?
I studied English and history and geography.
Okay.
And I actually, I did those three subjects. I then decided that I needed to do something which was vocational for my degree. So I went to London University and I did business studies. And what I found was that business studies was desperately dull, and it was being taught by people that had never been in business. And I just couldn't get inspired by it at all. So I ended up leaving that course and then extending my university by an extra year. And I then did English at university, did English literature, which just meant that I could, you know, read for 3 years, and which, you know, it was something that I love to read. I've always loved to read. So that, that was, for me, that was a good move. And I really believe that, especially once you get to university, you should do something that you're passionate about. And, you know, university success should be just about reaching a level in a subject that you love, rather than, you know, there's more and more pressure for your university degree to be vocational and career oriented, which I think is a real shame, because people end up doing things that they're less passionate about. Because I think business, learning about business, you can't really do at university. It's more about, you know, practical experience.
Just in terms of your business mind, was there ever early glimpses of you wanting to set up a business, even if it was like at school or anything like that, that springs to mind?
Yeah, well, I've always been, my dad is a serial entrepreneur, and it's very much in his blood. And he's set up businesses in all kinds of different industries. So from sportswear to jewelry to wigs to herbs to and spices. And he's had some tremendous success in a whole range of different types of companies. So around our dining table, there was always talk of setting up your own company and being an entrepreneur. And that was, you know, for me and Ben and my sister Flora, I think that's all we ever knew. So I think we were always gonna kind of do our own thing. And it was drummed into us from an early age that setting up your own company, being in control of your destiny, being an entrepreneur, was really the most exciting, the best thing that you could do. So I think it was drummed into me. It was certainly something that we talked about a lot as a family. And then when I was at Oxford at the tutorial college, I remember we put together this plan to drive, to rent a smart car and drive tourists around particular tourist destinations in and around Oxford.
Okay.
And, you know, put on a smart suit and drive them around and be able to talk a little bit knowledgeably about the places that we're going to. And we made a bit of money out of that, which lasted a few months.
Do you think that was your first business, if you could call it a business?
I think so. Yeah. And then me and a friend actually set up a car cleaning company where we'd just go knock on door to door. We'd go and knock on companies' doors and offer to clean their cars. And I remember that my friend was called Jason. So it was, we called it J&J Car Valet. So that was some early marketing there.
Yeah.
And it seemed to go reasonably well, but I think we were real perfectionists. So it took us far too long to clean a car. And then because we were walking from business to business, I don't think we ever really cleaned enough cars every day. So I don't think it was a very efficient model. So I don't think we made very much money out of it. But I was always trying to think of ideas.
Okay, cool. And what about your interest in computers and the IT world, technology? Was that something you had early on, or was it more led by the business side of things and that happened to be one?
I'm really not, I don't have any real early knowledge or track record with computers. And actually, nor does my brother, bizarrely. My first job was in advertising as a copywriter.
Okay.
Ben, with his original partner, Rory Sweet, they set up a business buying and selling secondhand IBM equipment in the very early 90s. And that sort of barely qualifies as technology. It's a really, really hard cowboy kind of business with really narrow margins, but they were doing reasonably well out of it. But they were looking for someone to run marketing and to try and help them, you know, market the company more effectively. The original business was actually called R&B Resources, which stood for Rory and Ben Resources, which kind of sounded like a mechanics yard rather than a computer business. So you could tell that they needed some marketing help. So they somehow persuaded me to join the business in probably about 92.
Do you remember how old you were?
So I would have been, give away your age, but I was born in 69. So I would have been 23, 24.
So you've been working after university for a few years And
yeah, no, I actually, I think I finished university about 1990, maybe 91. I did English, and then I didn't know what I wanted to do. I ended up moving to Thailand for about a year. I had a couple of friends who were living in Bangkok, they were in advertising, and they had fairly junior roles in London with an advertising network called, I think it was called Grays. And they were offered more senior roles to go and help set up the Bangkok office.
All right.
And they had a company apartment. So they said, why don't you come and stay on our couch? Yeah. And, you know, we're having a lot of fun in Bangkok. So I just randomly went out there with about £400 and I bought a fake English teaching certificate on the Koh San Road in Bangkok. I thought that I was entitled to do that as I had an English degree, but I had no idea what I was doing in terms of teaching. And that was actually interesting in itself, because when it's your first language, you're not necessarily a very good teacher. It's only when you've actually had to learn like a second language and you had to understand more about the structure and everything else.
Yeah.
But when it comes naturally to you, it's not necessarily so easy to teach someone else. But anyway, that's something that I learned.
Yeah.
But so I was living in Bangkok teaching English, and then one of my big clients was Bangkok Airways, who are the big domestic carrier in Thailand.
Yeah.
And at the time I was out there, they built an airport in an island called Koh Samui, this beautiful paradise island where they filmed the beach, and, you know, very well known. They built this little airport in Koh Samui for the first time, and Bangkok Airways were the airline that won the rights to fly into it. So they took on a lot of local staff in Koh Samui, and they called me in one day and said, "Yeah, Mr. Joss, you're probably not going to want to do this, but we're just wondering whether you'd like to spend a few months on Koh Samui teaching all our new staff and our, you know, air stewardess and everything, teaching them English." So I literally had a dream job where I was living on the beach, in a hut on the beach, all paid for, on Koh Samui, teaching beautiful Thai air stewardesses English. Anyway, I eventually very reluctantly felt that I needed to start doing something a bit more serious. So then I came back to the UK, and then I briefly went into advertising, and then I joined Ben and Rory at R&B Resources. And they were you know, in this cutthroat market, buying and selling IBM kit, which was hard.
Yeah. So that kind of brings us to the genesis of the first business almost, right? Like, how it sounds like the name is very similar. So you eventually set up RBR.
Yeah, what happened was one of our customers, this was probably in 92, 93, one of our customers who we used to sell IBM equipment to was BT, British Telecom. And one day they asked us for a Cisco router, and we were honestly calling them Kisco. We had no idea who this company was. But we found this Cisco router in the States, and we sold it to BT, and we made a bigger margin on it than we ever did with the IBM equipment. And then the next week they faxed through, you can tell it's a long time ago because I remember they faxed through a whole list of Cisco equipment. And again, we sourced it in the States and we sold it to BT, and we sold it at list price, and we'd bought it for about 50% off list price. And BT didn't bat an eyelid. They just paid full list price. And I think at that time the light went on for us, and we realized that the whole market seemed to be moving away from IBM mainframes, you know, one big central computer with terminals, with dumb terminals hanging off it. The world seemed to be moving away from these big IBM systems more towards this concept of PC-based networking, wide area-based networking, and this thing called the internet.
Yeah.
And this company called Cisco seemed to be at the forefront of this change. And they were small back then. Cisco, exactly. And we liked them, and they seemed to be aggressive and interesting business, but they didn't even have a presence in the UK back then. And so the early buyers of Cisco, like BT, were having to buy directly from Cisco in the States on like 6 to 8 week lead time. So they desperately needed a second supplier who could actually supply things more immediately.
Okay.
So we became the first major supplier of Cisco equipment in the UK before Cisco themselves.
Okay.
You know, that was an amazing market to get into so early, and it just went ballistic pretty quickly. Yeah.
So, at this point, what point did it become RBR Networks?
One of the first things I did when I joined and we started to get into the Cisco market is change the name. So I just thought, you know, R&P resources didn't sound terribly sharp and modern. Yeah. So we changed to RBR Networks, and networks obviously in reference to the Cisco equipment and what they did. We changed the name pretty early on. And we just became a specialist supplier for Cisco. We didn't sell any other manufacturer's equipment.
Yeah.
And we used to source it from the States, sell it to all the early buyers of Cisco in Europe, which are people like BT and Siemens and Deutsche Telekom and people like that.
Yeah.
And within 3 or 4 months, we were doing more than £1 million a month in Cisco.
It's crazy. And do you remember the first, I mean, it's a bit of time ago now, but do you remember the first sale you had and how did that come about? Because were they coming to you or?
Yeah, well, the first sale was to BT. So, and I actually did that. Ben and Rory were on one of their many skiing holidays. And the order for the Cisco equipment came through when I was there. You know, I think I was there maybe with one other person. There's only a few of us. And, ended up doing that deal. And I remember being absolutely terrified because I was like 24 and just thinking, you know, if I screw this up, then I don't think Ben and Rory are going to be very happy with me. Got to try and make sure that I get this deal done and, you know, go and buy myself a new car or something. We managed to get it done. And, but that was a major, major breakthrough for us. Yeah. And obviously Cisco went from, you know, not having a presence in the UK to briefly in the 90s being the largest company on the planet.
Oh, really?
And so it happened within the space of just a few years. And we were right there at the right time. So it was very exciting.
That's great. And just quickly, were you the youngest of the three?
Yeah. Yeah, so Ben and Rory are... Ben's 18 months older than me.
Okay, so
he's my older brother. And Rory is a little bit older than Ben, yeah.
Okay. That's just good to know how, you know, the kind of how it worked out between all three of you. And it sounds like you were the marketing guy, marketing sales. I guess you're wearing many hats in that situation, but how did you guys split up the responsibility?
Well, I guess I don't think we really thought about it as much as we probably should have done. Yeah. Rory is a brilliant deal maker, just very, very bright. Really, really makes things happen, but is a very, very good deal maker. And that was obviously a really important part of what we were doing. Ben is very good at sales, and he's a very good people person, kind of getting people to believe and getting people to do much more than they ever thought was possible. I think I'm more on the marketing, communications, product, that side of things. And maybe more on the kind of strategy as well, kind of looking a little bit sort of further into the future.
Yeah. And I asked the audience if they had any specific questions. And one of the things that came up a few times was that transition from being the marketing person or, you know, whatever skill that you were focused on at that particular moment to being someone who's running the business rather than executing on one particular thing. So when you started hiring people, for example, your job was then to get them to do a lot of those tasks you were doing before. So as you started to scale up, do you remember that mindset shift?
I think it just kind of happened. I was certainly more aligned to marketing. Over time, I suppose you start to take on more sort of general management. Mm. I mean, I was always the CMO, the sort of head of marketing, head of product in each of our companies. Over time, you know, you're taking on more general management sort of responsibilities.
Yeah.
I think the important thing is to not, you know, to not have too big an ego about what you don't know.
Yeah.
So to be very honest with yourself about what I'm good at and what I'm not good at. And there's no shame in, you know, no one's good at everything. And if they think they are, then they're lying to themselves. And so I think to be honest with yourself about what you're not so good at and making sure you have people that you trust who can be valuable, you know, mentors or reference points for you as you're hiring, particularly hiring. I think, you know, because you in each of these areas, you need to hire really, really good people. And that starts with the person at the top. So if you get that right, you know, that's the most important thing probably. So to have some people in your network who can help you make the right decisions about hiring, I think is really important.
Yeah. That's great. At that stage, did you know what your weaknesses were as well as you know them now?
Probably not. No, I was probably sort of naive and you know, thought I was better at stuff than I actually was, thinking about it.
Do you remember some of the things that you weren't so good at, or you're still not good at, that you have had to delegate to other people?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I think really getting into the numbers, so the financial side, understanding a spreadsheet, understanding a P&L, understanding a financial model, you know, something that I'm still learning. But certainly back then, I really didn't, you know, didn't have a clue really what I was talking about. I could look at things from a very high level, yeah, not in any real detail.
Yeah. Okay.
And I mean, there's lots of things, but I think, on the sales side, the need to really understand the kind of science behind selling. So actually understand, well, you know, well, sales and marketing, but particularly sales, if we're, you know, if I have contact with X number of companies and I can convert, you know, a percentage of those into the pipeline, I can convert a percentage of those into sales, and what's my average deal size, and and really understanding how things move through the funnel, and your sales cycle, your conversion rate, and the capacity that each salesperson is able to do, and looking at things like, you know, often sales plans will fall down because companies are too optimistic about how quickly they'll hire the right people, and that and also the retention rates of salespeople. So there's always attrition in a sales team.
Yeah.
And when there's attrition, and that might be good people, or it might be, you know, kind of planned attrition, but when there's attrition, you then have to go back out to the market, you have to hire more people. Not only that, and that can take some time, but then you have to get them up to speed.
Yeah, train them.
And that capacity planning around turnover and attrition is very often the area where sales plans fall down on.
Yeah.
And, you know, certainly back then I wouldn't have thought about anything like that.
What about in the beginning, how did you guys fund the business? Because you were doing, it sounds like really quickly you were getting a lot of revenue in, but the initial money to actually set things up, to move into an office, to, there was probably legal fees, you know, whatever it might be. How did you guys fund that in the first place?
Yeah, we, I mean, with difficulty. Yeah. I mean, the RBR was cash generative and profitable from very, very early stage. I mean, pretty much from day one. But the trouble is we had real cash flow challenges, because we would source the equipment generally on the gray market.
Yeah.
Where we'd have to pay, and certainly until we got much, much bigger, we'd have to pay up front.
Okay.
Then we'd be selling to people like BT on 30, 45, 60 day lead times.
Yeah.
So even though the margins are that, you know, that we were making good money, the cash flow was always very, very painful.
And
so we were always living kind of, you know, right on the edge.
Yeah.
On that. And so we did take an investment from actually a friend's father's company.
Yeah.
I think it was like a couple of million, which helped. We used to factor our debt as well.
What does that mean?
It means that if you have large invoices from a well-respected company, like if BT owe us $100,000, that there's a factoring company that will give you most of that money in because they believe that that invoice will be paid. It's just a question of when. But then you end up paying interest on that. And, you know, so that was one of the reasons why we eventually sold RBR is because even though the business was really profitable, the cash flow was always very, very hard. And over time, the margins come down as the market matures. And, you know, in a distribution business like that, you really have to wipe the board clean and you start again every month.
Yeah.
So that kind of, that's partly what drew us to a recurring revenue business or a service business where, you know, you're actually generating revenue, you know, over the long term each and every month, rather than having to, you know, wipe the board clean each month. And you know, that's a tough environment.
Yeah. No, great. So you were generating quite a lot of money straight away. People were probably already coming to you directly since you became their official partner or distributor.
We actually had a really rocky relationship with Cisco, because soon after we establish ourselves. Cisco then came into the UK, set up their own two-tier distribution model, and we didn't fit into that. So they couldn't recognize our revenue, and that just drove them mad.
Yeah.
They couldn't really control us. And you know, all their managers weren't being rewarded for the business that we were doing. And
okay.
So they actually, to start with, they tried to shut us down. They sent letters to all our customers saying that don't buy from RBR. It's not an authorized channel. You won't get warranties and all this. But in some ways, that actually made our customers even more loyal to us because they didn't like being told what to do.
Yeah.
Especially not in the UK, you know, being told what to do by an big American company.
Yeah, yeah.
So it actually didn't really harm our progress all that much. And in some ways, it actually made customers more loyal to us. I mean, we did a good job. We knew what we were doing because we just spent, all we did was Cisco. So we knew the products inside out.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, the business was always built on sand. Without Cisco's backing, it was never going to be worth anything.
Yeah,
so eventually, and principally Rory, who was a brilliant negotiator and deal maker and handled this very well. But eventually we got around the table with Cisco and their lawyers, and we agreed, because I think they knew they needed us as much as we needed them. And we agreed to only buy from them, to buy from authorized channels, and we agreed to only sell in the UK and Ireland.
Yeah.
And in return, they made us a distributor. And this was in 96, I think. And there was only four distributors in the UK.
Okay.
So little old us and, you know, in the middle of nowhere in Gloucestershire.
Yeah.
Became an authorized distributor. And I think that, you know, that was obviously very important.
Yeah.
Important to us.
Yeah. So, and how long was it before you ended up selling that company?
We sold it in 98 to Datatech.
And we'll get to the sale in a minute because that's exciting to hear about. But in terms of, again, that scaling part, so you talked a lot about finding really good people. Do you remember one of the first key hires you guys made? And how did you find good people back then? I mean, this is pre-LinkedIn.
Yeah, well, I think it was very hit and miss, to be honest.
Yeah.
But yeah, I remember we hired someone to run sales in RBR, someone called Tracy Williams. And she was really, really strong, and I think really opened our eyes to how to run and scale a sales organization. She'd done it previously with another networking company, I think a distributor actually, and she added a lot. And I think over time, it's just sort of pattern recognition, you know. You start to better recognize the right traits and the right signs, but also I think you take more time over the recruitment, you know, that for me, there's nothing more valuable than getting in, not a reference that they give you, because they're always going to be good. It's almost not worth taking them out.
Yeah.
But to actually get an inside reference from someone that's worked with them, but not a reference that they've given you, but someone that you trust, who's actually got some
knowledge. How did you manage to get that?
We don't always get it.
Yeah.
But I think when you can, that's really, really valuable. I think to get other people, even from outside the company, involved in the recruitment process, giving you their, you know, their sense of, you know, the strength of the candidate. And then we always used to, and we didn't in the early days, but over time, we always used to give a candidate a task, like an assignment to do, which again, you know, would often kind of annoy them. And this is not in the early days, we'd just make these decisions really quickly, far too quickly, prematurely, and we'd make a lot of mistakes. But over time, you know, that was an important part of the interview process, is get an inside reference, get, you know, real true experts that you trust to give you their view from outside the company, and also set them an assignment that would demonstrate how they might actually be in the actual job. And, you know, so I guess over time you learn those things.
So let's get to the exciting part of selling the company. So the first sale, how much was it? It was $40 million, right?
I think it's about $50 million.
Okay.
Yeah. There was an earn out. I think by that time our revenues were about just over $100 million. We were still growing rapidly. It just, the margins were narrowing. The market wasn't as exciting as it used to be. With RBR, I mean, it was more Rory and Ben. I was a smaller shareholder in RBR. But I think they just felt you know, we'd been living hand to mouth to some extent. Yeah. They felt that it was an opportunity to take some money off the table. Yeah. And, you know, I was 28 at the time. Yeah. They weren't much older than that. So it was a lot of money for us.
Yeah, of course.
In our 20s. And, you know, so we sold the business and did what you do in your 20s when you make a lot of money.
Yeah, what?
Which is, you know, we're all driving around in Lamborghinis and Ferraris and God knows what. And, you know, we had a lot of fun.
Yeah.
You know, some fun parties and stuff. But actually, Ben and I had then gone on to set up Star.
Oh, yeah.
So in some ways, that was good, I think, because we immediately had another focus.
Yeah.
And some, you know, something that we were really committed to focus our energies. And we also put quite a lot of money from RBR into Star in the early days. Mm. So that was our kind of next adventure.
Yeah. I just want to hear a little bit more about that day itself. So you sold, well, I'm sure it was probably going on for some time, but when you actually got the confirmation in, you know, you said you were doing some fun, silly stuff, but
yeah. I remember there was a local newspaper, because we were in Cirencester, which is right in the middle of a sort of farming world. We always used to joke that, you know, we kind of misread the memo, and instead of setting up in Silicon Valley, we set up in Stroud Valley in the middle of Gloucestershire. But I remember the local newspaper, I think it was called the Wilts and Gloss Echo or something.
Yeah.
I remember they came to photograph us and they wanted some sort of glamour picture. And I don't actually have this picture. I'm sure someone's got it.
I'm sure we can dig it out from the internet.
And I think there's me, Ben and Rory, and they insisted on us holding a sort of obligatory bottle of champagne and draped over. I think at the time, one of us already had quite a flash car. So we were sort of draped over the bonnet of a smart car holding a bottle of champagne. And it was all like very naff and like parochial. But I can remember that quite clearly, yeah.
And we're going to go to Meshes Labs in a second. But since we're talking about the day that you sold, how was that the third time you did it? Because by this point, you'd sold another company in the middle. The last one, obviously, was a lot bigger. It was $700 million. So even though it's a huge amount, you were a little bit more experienced, a little bit more mature.
Yeah.
How did you react that day?
With Meshes Labs, it was a much, much bigger exit. So potentially much more money on the table. I mean, for me with RBR, I sort of frittered away most of that money. And then Star was a much longer and winding road. We actually ended up selling Star after RBR, interestingly.
Oh, really? Okay.
So with RBR, with Meshes Labs, I'd moved out to New York in 2002 to build Meshes Labs in the US. And I had an amazing time in New York, but for various reasons, you know, New York's a fun place and you kind of live for the moment to some extent. So
yeah.
I was certainly pretty heavily in debt when we sold Meshes Labs.
Oh, really? Okay.
And, you know, not sort of, it wasn't anything that was sort of keeping me awake at night, but I was slowly getting into debt. And So it was really, really important for me to get the exit in that way, as well as, you know, it wasn't like I was comfortable at the time and this was just an exit sort of adding to my wealth or whatever. It was something that, it was really important to me financially and for, you know, for everything that we'd built up to get an exit like that.
Yeah. Let's fast forward to Meshes Labs. How did you guys come up with that concept? Where did, you know, it was very different to your first company.
Yeah. Well, we were building Star as an ISP. And, I think we realized that the ISP industry was really about scale. It was about infrastructure.
Mm.
And we didn't have the hundreds of millions of dollars to spend on our infrastructure. So we were thinking about ways to differentiate ourselves from other ISPs. And we came up with various different services. So we came up with a live dashboard, performance dashboard for how your connectivity was performing. We had an email to fax service. But we also came up with this idea, and it was originally Ben that came up with this idea, which was, well, viruses are now riding on the back of email. They're now piggybacking on email. So wouldn't it make sense to actually, a bit like, you know, water is filtered closer to the source. So when you turn on the tap, it's already been filtered. You sort of take that for granted. We thought, well, wouldn't it actually make sense to build an antivirus system actually into the fabric of the internet or into the cloud? So a customer would simply redirect their traffic to one of our data centers and we would scrub it and pass it on. So then they don't have to worry about loading up antivirus software onto their own machines, onto their own PCs.
Yeah.
They can kind of outsource the problem. And also in doing that, we have greater economies of scale. If, you know, we can invest a lot more into our system on behalf of thousands of customers than you ever could do just within a single organization.
Mm.
And then we also realized pretty early on that in moving it into the cloud, we could deploy a more data-driven approach to recognizing viruses.
Yeah.
So traditional antivirus software works in a fingerprint reactive way. So you load up your antivirus software like Norton or whatever, and then they recommend every 30 days you download new updates, and the new updates enable the software to recognize new threats, and the software is looking for an exact match for a fingerprint of any new threat. So it's very reactive in the way that it works, and it was really designed in a pre-internet world. So we thought, well, why don't you move the whole process into the cloud? And by doing that, we could deploy a more data-driven approach. So we could look at things like the reputation of the sender.
Mm.
We could look at the actual patterns of movement within the email, because we realized when an email contained a virus, it followed a very distinct pattern of one email coming in and then lots of the same emails going out.
Yeah.
And then you could look inside the email itself for any signs of a previous virus, because viruses are always derivative of something that's happened, that's been written before.
Yeah.
So we had this ever-growing knowledge base, this algorithm, which enabled us to predictively identify a new virus without needing an exact match.
Yeah.
And the more data we had, the better that algorithm became.
Mm.
And so we were building this system which could recognize new viruses instantly, and no one else in the world could do that.
Yeah.
And that was a huge breakthrough at the time.
Yeah, that's great. So what about actually when you actually created it? Because if you think, you know, your first business was reselling equipment, right? Or selling equipment. When you're actually building software, in this case, the skill set is, you know, what you tell me, is it that different? I mean,
with the ISP, we were already getting more and more technical.
Yeah.
We'd hired a CTO called Mark Sunner, who was a brilliant guy.
How did you find him?
So we actually, you always have to have this luck along the way, but we were based in Cirencester, and actually one of the top technical training centers in the whole of the UK is called QA Training, and they're based in Cirencester.
All right.
So we hired Mark, and then he knew who, you know, a lot of the teachers, a lot of the trainers at QA had very senior tech jobs, and they would teach on the side, they'd teach part-time. So we hired Mark, and then Mark picked out a few of the other top people from QA Training.
All right.
All our best technical people came from that source.
Amazing.
And I don't think the business would have happened without that.
Yeah.
So that was really important.
That's great.
Yeah.
And so again, just to touch on the funding of this particular business, by this point you had already had an exit. You'd already had two. So were you funding this all yourself, or did you guys go to raise money?
No, we raised money for Star in 98. And we raised, I think, about $10 million in 98 for Star from a group of investors led by Lord Rothschild and his investment, one of his investment vehicles. And then in 2000, we founded Message Abs in 2000. And so then we had Star and Message Abs under the same umbrella as part of the same, you know, legal entity. So we raised money principally for Message Apps in 2000. And that was the height of the dot-com boom.
Yeah, I was about to say,
So, you know, crazy things were happening, crazy valuations. We actually managed to raise money. And Message Apps had only been going for about 10 months. We already had a pretty big user base, but that was partly because we just ported our users from Star, because the Message App service originally just existed within Star. as a kind of prototype. And then it became so successful within Star that we actually set up a separate company and a separate brand to scale up the technology.
Yeah.
So a user base had been kind of developed, accumulated within Star, and then we ported that across to MessageAbs. But I'd say in 2000, when we raised money, MessageAbs had about 500,000 users of its antivirus service. You know, certainly single digit millions of revenue. And we managed to raise money at more than $100 million
okay.
valuation. So, you know, that was the height of the boom. And it was a good time to be raising money. Yeah. So we raised money from US investors because we felt we wanted US investors to help underpin our expansion into the US market.
Yeah.
And so we raised money from Madison Dearborn and Catalyst.
How did you make that happen? Just, you know, actually getting a connection? Did you just call their office or, you know, how did it work back then?
No, we had a contact called Mark Mullen who worked for a small tech advisory sort of M&A fundraising bank called Daniels. And we got to know Mark because he was always trying to encourage us to sell Star, or he's always coming up with various sort of M&A opportunities for Star. And so we actually ended up using him to raise money for MessageAbs, and he did a good job connecting us to various US investors. So, I mean, it was a good time to be raising money as well. And we actually got in just in time.
Yeah.
If we tried to raise money another 6 months later into 2001, we probably wouldn't have been able to do it. But we raised $40 million at a big valuation, and we never raised any more money.
Oh, really? Okay.
So we really got in the right time. I mean, it was hard because then, you know, 2001, 2002, 2003, you know, the business was suddenly worth a hell of a lot less than when we raised money. And, you know, the relationship with our investors was certainly strained. And, you know, it was difficult because I think our investors felt they'd invested at a overinflated valuation. Yeah. And, you know, we felt we'd just kind of gone along with the environment at the time.
Yeah.
But then, you know, when the crash happens, it's difficult all around to sort of manage your way through that. But we, you know,
so how did you navigate that? Because it was shortly after there was the crash, you'd already raised money. Yeah. Were investors panicking, asking for money back or what?
No, they didn't do that. But certainly Madison Dearborn, who are really just a big private equity company, a big private equity house. They're not really a VC. But in 2000, you know, everyone was trying to become a VC.
Yeah,
so private equity firms were setting up a VC, you know, division. Everyone was trying to get into venture capital. So they moved into venture capital. But then when the crash happened, people like Madison Dearborn moved out of venture capital as quickly as they'd moved into it.
Yeah.
So we, you know, we suddenly didn't really fit into their portfolio.
Okay.
We were a bit of a sort of orphan within their portfolio, and we didn't really receive very much support from them.
Yeah.
And it was the wrong decision for us. We actually shouldn't have chased the valuation.
Okay.
We should have gone with tried and tested, experienced VCs who are going to be with us for the long term. But instead, I think we chose the investor that was prepared to pay the highest valuation, which in the overall scheme of things, I don't think was the right thing to do. But Catalyst were more, they were better. They were more supportive.
Okay, great. And when you did sell MessageLab, how did you know that was the right time to sell? And you'd mentioned earlier, you know, financially you were in some debt personally.
Yeah.
But you know, how did you know it was the right time not to wait for a bigger valuation, or, you know, how did you make that decision?
I don't think we did, but I think that what really happened, I mean, MessageAbs, by 2008, we were the second largest software as a service company in the world. That's great. We had $150 million of recurring revenue. We had about 550 people. We had offices in 15 countries. We were processing 2 billion emails every day. So we were the largest processor of email in the world. We were a big, big company, much bigger than we ever imagined we would be. And we were gearing up for an IPO.
Yeah.
And we had appointed bankers. So we had Citi, JP Morgan, Cazenove as bankers. We were working on our prospectus. Our bankers would come in every month and to update us on the process. So we were very much gearing up for a big IPO, and we were really, really excited about that. As 2008 unfolded, By about probably June, our bankers very reluctantly said, you know, and this was long before Lehman, crashed and you know, the markets really went into meltdown. But they said by about June 2008 that with what was happening in the wider market, that we weren't going to be able to go public.
Yeah.
But we were running a dual track process, as you usually do when you go public, because if someone really, really wants to buy you and they want to pay you a big price, they'll often rather do that before you go public, because once you're public and your valuation can increase even more, and then, you know, you kind of, you're more in control of your own destiny, and you've got the funding and everything else and the currency to continue to build the company. So often people will try and buy you, you know, before you IPO. So because we're running a dual track process, and even though we knew that we weren't going to be able to IPO, we carried on with the acquisition side of the process, still kind of making out that we were working towards a listing. And we ended up negotiating pretty far down the line with Symantec and IBM and Cisco, actually, which is an interesting sort of full circle with them. We ended up selling to Symantec in October of 2008. So yeah, we had a price set, which I think was actually $800 million. And then Lehman's bankruptcy happened, and then the markets really started to go into meltdown. And then what really affected our process is that the pound in those days was 2-1.
2-1, I remember, yeah.
So we agreed that, okay, so it's going to be $800 million, it's going to be £400 million. That was the price. Suddenly, within the space of like a month, the pound went from 2-1 to 1.5-1. Most of our shareholders were in pounds. So suddenly they were faced with getting significantly less for the deal than they thought they were going to get. So we had to kind of realign the deal. So we ended up calculating the deal based on pounds, and then, you know, that it was just, it just got very, very complicated because of the multiple currencies.
Yeah.
And but we managed to figure it out and get the deal done. I think both sides had a lot invested in it. So
yeah. By the time you got the 700, you know, you mentioned the value had gone down quite a bit, but by the time you sold, you were all happy with the price.
Yeah, I think the deal was struck in pounds.
Yeah.
Because I think Symantec, as most tech companies do, they have these other currencies and they don't repatriate the currencies, because then there's a big tax bill to repatriate the currencies back into dollars.
Yeah.
So they tend to leave a lot of the currencies out in their, you know, in their global operations. And then that can be a very good source of funds for an acquisition if you're buying a foreign company. Yeah. So I think that the deal was struck in pounds, but then the US-based shareholders, so myself, Catalyst, some of our investors, who were dollar-denominated, then suddenly were faced with getting a lot less when the conversion rate changed. So that was a complicated kind of wrinkle in our negotiations. But I think at the end of the day, we were pretty happy with the price. I mean, we got about 5x revenue, which actually these days for a SaaS business, is on the low side. But I think, you know, given that there was such a recession going on, and, you know, we were making money at a time where all assets were pretty significantly depressed. So then, you know, having made that money, whatever we invested it in would have, you know, generally is a good time to have money and a good time to be investing in pretty much any asset class. So I think generally looking back on it, it was felt like the right time. It was 8 years as well, which again, 8 years feels like a good amount of time for a startup to really create value.
Looking back at your entrepreneurial career so far, do you have a highlight?
Yeah, I mean, I think when the Message Apps deal was actually done, I think was definitely a real highlight, because to be negotiating that deal with the backdrop of, you know, the whole sort of financial meltdown that was going on in the world, and the deal kept getting delayed, and the, you know, the sort of last minute issues, complications, and you know, as I said, I certainly, you know, my financial situation wasn't all that great at the time, so it was certainly good timing for me. But I think it was a culmination of all those years of hard work and believing that we could really build this really big business, and for it to finally happen. And I remember it was a beautiful day. It was in October, and I remember I went to Central Park with my sister and my wife and with a bottle of champagne and a cigar. And I remember just lying on the lawn, just because we were told that the deal had finally got signed at 4 a.m. or something. And I remember we just went out and just lay out on the lawn, and I was smoking a cigar, and you know, that was pretty cool. But there were lots of highlights.
Well, thanks a lot for sharing all of that. So just, I know we don't have too much time left. So I did want to ask you a little bit about what you're doing nowadays, since you're now on the other side of the table. You're investing in startups with Notion Capital as a VC, and you've also got some angel investing that you do privately too, right? Yep. So just being an ex-entrepreneur and having gone through that whole process, what is your... how do you take on investing with that hat on, being an ex-entrepreneur?
Well, I think it's difficult, to be honest, because I think entrepreneurs tend to be very positive.
Yeah.
Generally quite easy to sell to, very positive, very optimistic. So I think that I have a tendency, as do most entrepreneurs, to believe too much in the upside of an opportunity and maybe not be discerning enough about the realities of the downside and the risk profile and everything else. So that's definitely been a learning for me to, you've got to have a really, really high bar before you invest in something. And the way that I've sort of distilled it down is to look at the team, the product and the market, which I think are really the kind of cornerstones of any startup.
Yeah.
And I think, and I haven't always done this, by the way, but when I haven't, generally hasn't worked out so well. I think you want to feel really, really good about each of those things. You want to have real conviction, and not just good, but I think you want to feel that there's something special and something unique and something dynamic and something that gets you excited about each of those three areas. Before you want to move forward.
Do you have any advice for any entrepreneurs who are trying to raise money? What are the common mistakes people are making when they come into your room?
One obvious one to me is, I think that you've got to be able to explain what you do in a sentence or, you know, one or two sentences. An so not 30 pitch, seconds, or... not 2 minutes, not 5 minutes.
Yeah.
But you've got to be able to explain what you do, even to a non-technical audience.
Yeah.
Really, really briefly and crisply. Because if you can't do that, then how are people that are looking to invest in you or that are thinking about buying from you or thinking about partnering with you, how are they going to understand what it is you do? How are they going to then communicate it to their stakeholders? You know, if I'm an investor... and I'm talking to my team about an investment, and I find myself going around in circles about trying to explain it because I don't feel that necessary. I mean, maybe it's partly my fault, but, you know, I'm sure often it is. But, you know, I think that ability to crisply and simply explain what you do is one of the most important things. And actually, if you can't explain what you do in a compelling, simple way, it's probably not the right thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's often like the most simple things are the best. Like, you know, we said... at Message Apps, well, we're going to scan your email before it reaches you.
Yeah.
So you don't have to worry about it.
Yeah.
That's it, really.
Simple.
I think you need something similar. And it's a bit like there's a famous Winston Churchill quote, and I never quite get it right, but he says something like, you know, I'm afraid I'm going to have to give you my 45-minute speech because I didn't have time to write my 10-minute one.
Yeah.
And actually, it's harder to simplify.
Definitely.
And to shorten. But you really, really need to do it. And if you can't, what you're doing is probably too complicated.
You know, you've had some great exits. You've had a great career already. Why are you still doing this? What's motivating you right now?
I don't know. I still have this desire to succeed and this desire to prove people wrong. I mean, I think most entrepreneurs have a bit of a chip on their shoulder.
Yeah.
and I don't know whether I've quite got it in me to build another business, but to hear from entrepreneurs with their hopes and their dreams and their you know, what they're trying to do, and to have the opportunity to back them and to go on that journey with them and to have that sort of variety where, you know, you might be working with 5 or 10 companies, and to see the progress that they're making and the excitement and everything else, you know, I find that tremendously exciting. And actually, having built companies myself, it is quite one-dimensional. You know, you just don't have, you probably should do it more actually, but you don't have much time to stick your head above the parapet. Whereas an investor, you have to be out there all the time. And so you meet a lot more people outside. You have a smaller team inside, and I miss some of that, but you meet a lot more people outside. You hear a lot more different types of companies. There's more variety to what you do. And I just think being able to spend time with entrepreneurs and back great yeah. entrepreneurs and spend time with them is really, really inspiring. But I think also, you know, I still do have a bit of a chip on my shoulder, and I still have a, you know, determination to do well and prove people wrong. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs have that, and maybe it's partially extinguished, but I'm not sure it ever really is.
Yeah. You mentioned success there. What does success mean to you? Cause it's quite a broad term, means a lot of different things to different people.
Yeah. Well, I think as I get older, the financial side becomes less and less important. And I think success, I don't know, you start to look at it slightly differently, but I think to believe in a company, to believe in an entrepreneur, to believe in a founder, and see them do what they told you that they're going to do,
yeah,
or even do it yeah. even more than they said. I think, you know, that to be able to back someone and they go on and really deliver,
that's exactly.
I think is incredibly exciting. But, you know, I more and more, you know, I kind of look outside of my business, outside of the business world yeah. now. And, you know, I think more and more about, you know, the I guess more emotional things. You know, people say that happiness is about, giving and receiving love, yeah. for example,
yeah.
which is a common definition of happiness. And
yeah.
if someone had said that to me 10 years ago, I just would have just thought, you know, that's just sounds like some hippy dippy load of yeah, rubbish. Yeah. But now, you know, I start to understand that more. Yeah. And I think, you know, having really been fortunate enough to make some money now, you realize that it doesn't solve all your problems.
Yeah, definitely.
It makes everything a little bit easier, but actually, you know, what's important is probably, you know, beyond money, and it's more about relationships, and it's more yeah. about, you know, the way that you give back to people and to the world that you're in and everything else. And, you know, I think more about that than I used to, yeah. certainly.
Do you think having financial success leads to or implies any social responsibility that an average Joe doing a normal job who hasn't had that amount of success, do you think that means you might have more?
Well, it's interesting because I think it probably does. I mean, I think it's proportionate. So I think yeah. everyone has time.
Yeah, definitely.
And most people have some money. So I think a percentage of that
yeah.
should be given back, should be allocated to giving back.
Yeah.
And I contribute, you know, I donate to charities, sort of a wide ranging number of charities, but I still don't feel with my time, which in a way is much more scalable. If you give your time and then it's yeah. a bit like, you know, teaching people to fish rather than fishing yourself. You know, I don't feel I necessarily give it enough time. I don't really have a strategy for giving back. I don't feel I give it as much time as I should do, even though I think I contribute financially.
Yeah.
So it's actually something I've been thinking about a lot recently. And actually as a family, I thought it would be interesting to think about between myself, my wife and my 3 kids, we could sit down as a family and say, right, with my time this year, yeah. I'm going to do 3 things.
Yeah.
You know? And for the kids, it might be, I'm just going to go and, you know, help serve food on Thanksgiving or whatever it is. But it's interesting to think about it, time and money. And actually maybe at the beginning of the year, writing down, making some sort of commitment to yourself. And I guess just thinking about it more proactively. I still think I'm quite reactive about it.
Yeah. Last couple of questions. We mentioned success before, you know, being happy, but as well as you backing people. If you think of the word success, is there anyone who really comes to mind? People that you know, or even famous people that you might not know personally?
Well, to me, and this is something that I've wrestled with my life, and maybe that's part of the chip that I have on my shoulder, which I feel more and more comfortable with, but I'm still by no means there. But to me, the the happiest people are, so for me, you know, success is happiness, really.
Yeah.
And I think that the happiest people are those that are completely comfortable in their own skin.
Yeah.
So they don't feel that they necessarily have anything to prove. They may not be necessarily the best entrepreneurs, but I'm very envious of people who are just comfortable in their own skin. They're not striving to be anything that they're not.
Yeah.
Just what they have is enough. Like, I am enough. Yeah. Right? I, you know, this is enough. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's a certain amount to be learned, or, you know, to think about there. There's a famous TED talk about that. I think it's called like something like "You're Enough" or whatever. And I can't remember the girl that gives it. But anyway, that's an interesting theme, I think.
That's great.
Yeah.
And last question is, what do you want to be remembered for? If your grandkids were listening to this in 20 years.
Well, you know, I like to think that I've had a really good entrepreneurial journey. And that's been amazing, and I've met lots of extraordinary people and had great times and lots of success, and, you know, so I'm proud of that. I'm proud that my dad instilled that in me, and I think Ben and I went on to be successful, and, you know, so hopefully I can be remembered for, you know, building good businesses and employing a lot of people and building teams and, you know, to some extent helping to put UK and Europe tech on the map.
Definitely.
But I don't know, I feel, and again, and maybe it's just, you know, I'm getting older.
Yeah.
But I feel there's so much more to it than that.
Yeah.
You know, I want my kids to be, like I said, I'd like my kids to be, they don't have to be mega successful and mega wealthy. I just like them to be comfortable in their own skin and respect people. And be, you know, be very comfortable with diversity and, you know, every different type of people in the world, and be prepared to give back and, you know, just be comfortable with themselves. But I still feel there's a lot more for me to do and a lot more that I want to do.
Yeah.
Not just as an investor, but in terms of actually giving back. And so I feel that maybe what I'll be remembered for is still to come.
That's a great way to finish. So thanks so much. This has been super fun and I've learned a lot. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks, Bilal.
Cheers.
I hope you enjoyed that. If you did, please share this with your friends. I'll be bringing you some incredible guests over the coming weeks. You can subscribe on iTunes, on Stitcher, or any podcast app you're using. You can also subscribe to the email list on the website. Just go to creatorlab.fm/subscribe. You'll be able to get every single episode, free giveaways, and exclusive content straight to your inbox. You can also listen to all the episodes on creatorlab.fm with all the show notes, books, links, any resources that were mentioned in the conversations. And please say hello. You can send me an email directly. That is hello@creatorlab.fm, or just find me on any social network. The username is creatorlabfm. I look forward to hearing from you. Enjoy.